Washington and voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you.
Good afternoon from the magical Isle of Vashon. This is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair. And I am foregoing the music today because I want the time, as much as I enjoy marching around on the grinder at Cape May or the parade ground at the Academy in New London, I want the time because I have a couple things that are moving your captain's soul and spirit, and I want to get to those. So we start off with our regular greetings to the world, with Singapore on one side of the world and Stockholm on the other, and all of the aircraft in the air, all the ships at sea, especially all of those cutters that are on station and about their father's business. In I have heard from both Singapore and Stockholm, and both of them to some degree are on the binnacle list, not because of any physical problems, but because Singapore remains almost completely locked down. And my son, Sean, who is pretty much confined to his flat and is able to get out in very small groups, but that's about it. And in Stockholm, they are only at the first inoculation. And so I remain very concerned about both of those places and the people that I love who live in those places. But the binnacle list that I am talking about this morning struck me just this morning. I was next door having coffee and Fisher's Fair scones with my friend and neighbor Michelle. She, the Michelle who runs the chain of Kitty vending machines here on Vashon, and from whom came Sailor and little Miss Mary Sunshine. And we were talking about other things, and knowing that Michelle and Scott both originally came to Vashon from Denver, I said, oh, there was a shooting in Denver. And so she looked up the story on her little handheld device, this little telephone, miserable telephone, what I call the Andy phone, and Andy, for which I am enormously grateful, even I denigrate it. And all of a sudden, her precious face went white, and she said, oh my God. The police officer who was killed, Gordon Beasley, was the husband of one of Michelle's closest and dearest friends, Karen. And Karen had been with us just a few weeks ago at one of the campfires that we had at Captain's Quarters, so I had met her. So Officer Gordon, Officer Beasley, was the police officer that was shot and killed in that little town just outside of Denver, Arvada, Colorado. So we go along and we read about and we hear about these shootings all over the country. And we talk about what we can do to keep those from happening. And I'm not going to get into that discussion because there are people who are far more skilled at that sort of thing who are already screwing it up and accomplishing almost nothing to address this particular problem. All I'm going to talk about is a family with two teenage sons, a wonderful wife and mother, and a police officer of almost 20 years seniority on the little force in Arvada, Colorado. In a day, 2 days, 3 days, his coffin, draped with the flag, will be moved through that little town and taken to whatever is the last place for him to go. Every police officer, every person who is in every profession in which risks and hazards exist every day, knows and understands, and certainly an officer of his seniority knew, even in small towns, maybe especially in small towns, that that day may be the day that a brother officer will contact Karen, his wife, and say Gordon is not going to come home. Somebody, Karen, has to tell those two boys. Somebody has to tell his parents. Somebody has to work with the family to make sure that the family is protected from those who would denigrate the police officers who have sworn, they have sworn an oath to protect and defend. My heart goes out to that family. My heart goes out to all of the people who love that family. My heart goes out to Michelle and Scott, who in just a year have lost two of their dearest and closest friends. I don't know how we fix these things. As I indicated before, there are people who are far more capable of screwing it up than I am. But what I do know, because I have had to do it, is how hard it is to not only to tell the family that their particular person is not going to come home, but also to be that family. And so, from the captain's chair, and on behalf of all of Captain Joe's people, the signal is at half staff. And the signal is how sorry we all are and how helpless we all feel. And my hand is reaching out to touch Karen and her boy's fingertips. And that is what I have to say about all of that. Sort of tied to that is a signal that came to me in a different way. And that is that even here in the United States, which is supposed to be a land of such generosity, that because the things, the activities connected with the virus have been so horrendous, and people have died, crossed over the bar, as sailors say, for all of the reasons that are part of the cycle of life and death. And one of the things that has happened as a result of this is that the supplies of blood for surgeries, the supplies of blood for accidents, people are starting to travel now. People are starting to drive again out on the highways for the summer travel. There's a great deal of pent up and now unleashed enthusiasm for travel. And there are going to be accidents on the freeway system. And in many parts of the country, and the Pacific Northwest is one of them, the supply of blood in all of its forms is dangerously low. So my second hope, desire, wish, and even command from the captain's chair is if you are one of those who is able to donate blood. And there are many people who cannot for one reason or another. One of which I'm particularly familiar is people who have had hepatitis at one time, I believe, or are even now constrained. There was a period when we were living in the UK when the mad cow disease was being dealt with by massive pit digging and pushing of carcasses into these pits, sort of like the plague pits in medieval times. Cambridge has a huge plague pit on top of which is built the oldest college, Peterhouse in Cambridge, is built on top of the medieval plague pit. They pushed these cattle carcasses into these enormous holes. And if you had been living in the UK and had consumed any beef which possibly could have come from any of those cattle, and my medical listeners, if I've got any of this wrong, you are certainly encouraged to send me a signal and let me know. But what I do know is that if you had been in the UK within a certain period of time, you were not allowed to give blood. But if you are able and you meet all of the conditions of health and other, whatever other conditions there are, then I urge you to find a place and make a blood donation. And I am certain that it is easy to find a place where you can do that. I want to take another step back into the era of carrying on, because that's what we have to do, even in the face of situations which at first seem unbearable. The way that we bear them is to carry on. So I am going to now go back to a couple of my regular features. And one of my regular features is to recommend a book to you. So the book this week is called The Riddle of the Compass. It's written by Amir P. Axel, A-C-Z-E-L, Alpha Charlie Zulu Echo Lima, Axel. It is not a very large book. The type is relatively large. And it is printed on nice thick paper, so you can get through Mr. Axel's work in probably a day's reading, because it's a fascinating story. It's a little bit heavy on some of the peripheral history and a little bit light. And this, of course, is my book review, and this is the way my own personal biases and prejudices are cranking in here. A little bit heavy on some of the peripheral history and a little bit light on some of the history directly connected with the various versions of the magnetic compass. In the aggregate, though, it is a very interesting book, and for all sailors who use magnetic compasses today, and we still do, even in the most sophisticated ships, even in the most over-automated ships, even on the largest 20,000 TEU container ship, up on the bridge will be a magnetic compass. When all else fails, the magnetism that is induced in the Earth itself, of course, is an enormous magnet. That's how a magnetic compass works. And when all else fails, even if there's not a single bit of electricity, that magnetic compass will continue to point not to true north, but to magnetic north. One would hope that that compass is properly adjusted. As ships became metal, in particular ferrous metal, in other words, steel or iron derived from iron ore, that affected the magnetic compass, and systems were devised for compensating for the metal in the ship itself. On either side of the magnetic compass, you will find two round balls. These have adopted a certain purient sense, which I believe I am proscribed from talking about on the from the list of FCC prohibited words, but the technical term for them is quadrantal spheres. I learned how to adjust my own compasses, and I did indeed adjust the magnetic compasses in all of my ships. And every aircraft, even the most rudimentary, small ultralights, well, maybe not ultralights, but any aircraft that requires an N number, a November number, and requires a license, has a magnetic compass, and it has a means for adjusting that compass. And every yacht should have one. I am in the search for a boat that I can single hand, and it will indeed have a magnetic compass. And it will be properly adjusted, and I will do the adjustment myself. So, the Riddle of the Compass, and it is a very, very interesting book, and every sailor should take a look at it and read it, and also take a look at the bibliography. The bibliography is, I think, particularly complete and will lead you to further reading. In other book news, in my, not my post today, but the Wells Fargo wagon, also known as Federal Express, delivered a parcel to me today, and in that parcel was and is now sitting on my desk awaiting my attention, a copy of the book by a Dr. Robert Bunis, MD, and it is called Wind, Fire, and Ice, The Perils of a Coast Guard Icebreaker in Antarctica. And Dr. Bob has asked me to read the book and to write some commentary for the book jacket. So I've just received that. And Dr. Bob, if you're listening today, as you promised and you would, and I hope you do, I will get into it and will write my commentary for you. And of course, I will also talk about it on the program because this is a subject that is near and close to my heart. The name of the ship in which Dr. Bob sailed was the Coast Guard cutter Glacier. And Glacier was one of the ships that we acquired from the Navy. And I will talk a little bit about her when we also talk about the book after I've finished reading it and see how I like it and what I have to say about that. At anchor off of the off of Captain's Quarters in the Federal Anchorage is a ship with the wonderful name of Global Symphony. One would think, with a name like that, that she would be enormous, that she would be sparkling in the sunshine with her white paint scheme. She's on the Hong Kong flag. She's flying the Hong Kong flag. Which is separate and different from the Chinese flag, Chinese Communist flag, and which is an indication of the attempt on the part of the Hong Kong government to maintain some sense of autonomy. But if there was ever a situation about whizzing up a slack halyard in the long term, that one is the one that's going to be it. So she's a little bulk carrier. She's looks like she's about, I've not really gotten into her on marine traffic, but she has, interesting thing about her is that she's got the stakes up for loading logs on her deck. And she also has cranes where she can pick up her own hatch covers. I'll have more about her if she sticks around because she's an interesting little ship, a little ship with a great big name, Global Symphony under the Hong Kong flag. In June of 1948, the Berlin Airlift was started. And this is a piece of our history which is unfortunately, unhappily, all too quickly forgotten. But it is an example of both American ingenuity and American sticking with things and not giving up the ship. So what happened was that when World War II was over, Germany was divided up into several zones. The Soviet zone, which became East Germany, and then the British, the French, and the American zones to the west. Berlin was smack in the middle of the Soviet zone, but Berlin, under the terms of the treaties, which or the agreements, rather, that ended World War II with Germany, Berlin itself was divided up also into those four zones. And the way to get to Berlin through the Soviet zone was by way of three air corridors plus a rail line plus one highway, one of the German autobahns. The autobahns, of course, are the original interstate highways. They exist today, and if you want some real excitement, get on one of the autobahns that has no speed limit and do some competition with S-Class Mercedes as they zip up and down the autobahns at very close aboard and at 100 knots. So those were the three access ways to get into West Berlin. And for reasons which are beyond the scope of my time here, the Soviets closed all of the access routes, but under the terms of the agreement, they could not close down the three air corridors. And so when they did that, the food supplies and the fuel supplies into Berlin were cut off. And so the decision was taken. Kurt LeMay was the Air Force commander in Europe at that time. I don't think he had yet become the chief of staff of the Air Force. And in any case, the decision was taken to resupply Berlin flying into and out of West Berlin using the three air corridors. And so they were flying both C-47s, the DC-3, and C-54s, the DC-4, with intervals of 3 minutes. The amount of material that the city required in order to stay alive exceeded by quite a bit the amount that they could fly in each day until they began to shorten up the interval in which aircraft were brought in, and even more challenging, the distance separation between the aircraft. And if you take a look at some of the film clips of this, it is just an amazing operation. Also, they had to fly in fuel, coal, and petroleum products. The whole thing was a success. The Berliners had to go on short rations because there was no, they were not able to provide as much as the more optimistic estimators had said. But it was an amazing operation, and I hereby recognize all of the intrepid aviators, both Americans and Brits. By this time, the French were heavily involved in what was going to become our involvement in Vietnam, and so they were not able to provide much in the way of support, but the Brits and the Americans did this. And it was an amazing operation. I recommend that you do a little bit of reading about it, and you can find some film clips. The the French company Neoline has issued a letter of intent to build a cargo ship, which is going to be propelled by sail with an auxiliary engine. Now, this sort of thing has been talked about before, but we've never had a commercially viable cargo ship that was sail powered. There's an artist's conception of this particular ship on the article in G Captain. My good old friend Joe once again pointed me in the direction of this on G Captain, a wonderful website for people who are interested in matters nautical. And you'll notice that all of the sails are triangular sails, like we would use for a sloop rig. And it looks to me like a fairly simple and straightforward rig. It also looks to me like they're not going to get the 11 knots that they think they would like to get. Isn't that interesting? Because the great sailing ships of the golden era of sailing ship days, the clipper ships, and even more so the grain racers and the flying P line of Germany, 11 knots would be a good day's sail. And they're asking this ship to do 11 knots, and here we are at 2021. The route that they plan to sail these things is from Saint-Nazaire in France to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Halifax is a great sailor's town, by the way. I've been in and out of there a number of times. The French islands off of the North Atlantic or North American coast, Saint-Pierre and Miquelon, which I think are very interesting places, and which I plan to go to just to check them out, and Baltimore. That's the route that they're going to use this particular ship. Now, I can tell you, having been in and out of the port of Baltimore many times, that they are not going to sail Hey 9090 up into the port of Baltimore just under sail. Or if they do, the Coast Guard, the captain of the port, is certainly going to put a no on that. So she is going to have significant auxiliary power, and that's the way she's being advertised, that this is going to be, that the engine is going to be auxiliary power, that she's going to depend on the sails for her main propulsion. And the kicker to all of this, as always, Captain Joe's people, is all of this is dependent on needed financing. So we'll see whether the needed financing comes to pass. I close, as I always do, with my hope, wish, desire, and command that each one of you who are responsible for other people, take care of them, watch their six, protect and guard and treasure their six, and that know that your captain is deeply saddened today, and that's because some of my people are hurting, and I just want that word to go out that all of you who are close aboard to people who are hurting, take particular care of them and reach out and touch fingertips with them. So on that, it is, as always, your Captain Joe is up in the captain's chair. We never say goodbye. We say until we meet again right here at the captain's chair next Tuesday afternoon at 12:30, 1 bell of the afternoon watch on Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band and streaming live all over the world from voiceofvashon.org. I am up in
Hello, and welcome to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where authors from around the world